Chapter 47, A Canaanite Tribe Deceives Israel. From Shechem the Israelites returned to their encampment at Gilgal. Here a strange deputation represented that they had come from a distant country. This seemed to be confirmed by their appearance. Their clothing was old and worn, their sandals patched, their provisions moldy, and the skins that served them for wine bottles were rent and bound up as if hastily repaired on the journey. In their far-off home, professedly beyond the limits of Palestine, they had heard of the wonders which God had wrought, and had sent to make a league with Israel. The Hebrews had been specially warned against entering into any league with the idolaters of Canaan, and a doubt as to the truth of the stranger's words arose in the minds of the leaders. "Peradventure ye dwell among us," they said. To this the ambassadors replied, "We are thy servants." But when Joshua directly demanded of them, "Who are ye? And from whence come ye?" they added, "This our bread we took hot for our provision out of our houses on the day we came forth to go unto you, but now, behold, it is dry, and it is moldy, and these bottles of wine, which we filled, were new, and, behold, they be rent, and these our garments and our shoes are become old by reason of the very long journey." The Hebrews asked not counsel at the mouth of the Lord. And Joshua made peace with them, and made a league with them, to let them live, and the princes of the congregation sware unto them. Thus the treaty was entered into. 3 days afterward the truth was discovered. They heard that they were their neighbors, and that they dwelt among them. The Gibeonites had resorted to stratagem to preserve their lives. The indignation of the Israelites heightened when, after 3 days' journey, they reached the cities of the Gibeonites near the center of the land. But the princes refused to break the treaty, though secured by fraud, because they had sworn unto them by the Lord God of Israel. And the children of Israel smote them not. The Gibeonites had pledged themselves to renounce idolatry and accept the worship of Jehovah, and the preservation of their lives was not a violation of God's command to destroy the idolatrous Canaanites. Though the oath had been secured by deception, it was not to be disregarded. No consideration of gain, of revenge, or self-interest can in any way affect the inviolability of an oath or pledge. "He that shall ascend into the hill of the Lord, and stand in his holy place, is he that sweareth to his own hurt, and changeth not." How the Gibeonites made themselves to be slaves. The Gibeonites were permitted to live, but were attached as bondmen to the sanctuary to perform menial services. Joshua made them that day hewers of the wood and drawers of water for the congregation, and for the altar of the Lord. These conditions they gratefully accepted, glad to purchase life on any terms. "Behold, we are in thine hand," they said to Joshua, "as it seemeth good and right unto thee to do unto us, do." Gibeon, the most important of their towns, was a great city, as one of the royal cities, and all the men thereof were mighty. It is a striking evidence of the terror with which the Israelites had inspired the inhabitants of Canaan, that the people of such a city should have resorted to so humiliating an expedient to save their lives. But it would have fared better with the Gibeonites had they dealt honestly with Israel. Their deception brought them only disgrace and servitude. God had made provision that all who would renounce heathenism and connect with Israel should share the blessings of the covenant. With few exceptions, this class were to enjoy equal favors and privileges with Israel. Such was the footing on which the Gibeonites might have been received. It was no light humiliation to those citizens of a royal city, all the men whereof were mighty, to be made hewers of wood and drawers of water. Thus through all their generations, their servile condition would testify to God's hatred of falsehood. Joshua's long day. The submission of Gibeon filled the kings of Canaan with dismay. Steps were at once taken for revenge on those who had made peace with the invaders. 5 of the Canaanite kings entered into confederacy against Gibeon. The Gibeonites were unprepared for defense and sent a message to Joshua at Gilgal, slack not thy hand from thy servants, come up to us quickly, and save us, and help us, for all the kings of the Amorites that dwell in the mountains are gathered together against us. The danger threatened not the people of Gibeon alone, but also Israel. This city commanded the passes to central and southern Palestine, and it must be held if the country was to be conquered. The inhabitants of the besieged city had feared that Joshua would reject their appeal because of the fraud which they had practiced. But since they had submitted to Israel and had accepted the worship of God, he felt under obligation to protect them. And the Lord encouraged him. "Fear them not," was the divine message, "for I have delivered them into thine hand, there shall not a man of them stand before thee." So Joshua ascended from Gilgal, he, and all the people of war with him, and all the mighty men of valor. Scarcely had the Confederate princes mustered their armies about the city when Joshua was upon them. The immense host fled before Joshua up the mountain pass to Beth Horon, and having gained the height they rushed down the precipitous descent upon the other side. Here a fierce hailstorm burst upon them. The Lord cast down great stones from heaven, they were more which died with hailstones than they whom the children of Israel slew with the sword. While the Amorites were continuing their headlong flight, Joshua, looking down from the ridge above, saw that the day would be too short for the accomplishment of his work. If not fully routed, their enemies would renew the struggle. Then spake Joshua to the Lord, and he said in the sight of Israel, "Sun, stand thou still upon Gibeon, and thou, moon, in the valley of Ajalon." And the sun stood still, and the moon stayed, until the people had avenged themselves upon their enemies. The sun stood still in the midst of heaven, and hasted not to go down about a whole day. Before evening fell, God's promise to Joshua had been fulfilled. The enemy had been given into his hand. Long were the events of that day to remain in the memory of Israel. There was no day like that before it or after it, that Jehovah hearkened unto the voice of a man, for the Lord fought for Israel. The sun and moon stood still in their habitation, at the light of thine arrows they went, and at the shining of thy glittering spear. Thou didst march through the land in indignation, thou didst thresh the heathen in anger. Thou wentest forth for the salvation of thy people. Joshua had received the promise that God would overthrow these enemies of Israel, yet he put forth as earnest effort as though success depended upon the armies of Israel alone. He did all that human energy could do, and then he cried in faith for divine aid. The secret of success is the union of divine power with human effort. The man who commanded, "Sun, stand, thou still upon Gibeon, and thou, moon, in the valley of Ajalon," is the man who for hours lay prostrate upon the earth in prayer at Gilgal. Men of prayer are men of power. This mighty miracle testifies that the creation is under the control of the Creator. In this miracle, all who exalt nature above the God of nature stand rebuked. At his own will God summons the forces of nature to overthrow the might of his enemies, fire and hail, snow and vapor, stormy wind fulfilling his word. We are told of a greater battle to take place in the closing scenes of earth's history, when the Lord hath opened his armory, and hath brought forth the weapons of his indignation. The Revelator describes the destruction that is to take place when the great voice out of the temple of heaven announces, "It is done." He says, "There fell upon men a great hail out of heaven, every stone about the weight of a talent."